You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Three teams in the NL Central got off to 3-0 starts for the brand new baseball season, but they may not be the three teams you're thinking of. Plus, a frightening injury to Cubs slugger Kyle Schwarber, among the many topics we discuss this week in our NL Central podcast. We kick things off with Reds reporter Mark Sheldon.
Let's kind of recap the week that was for the Reds, and a darn good one. But it's kind of a good news, bad news scenario for the Reds. The good news is that the Reds, one of just four teams in baseball as we speak, with a record of 3-0. But the bad news is two of the other three teams reside in the same freaking division. So, yes, the wins did come against the Phillies, but, Mark, a 3-0 start is a 3-0 start, and the Reds have to feel pretty good right now.
They do, and obviously they're facing a team that's kind of in their boat. They're also rebuilding, so it's you do temper it, but at the same time, you got to play the schedule as it comes, and you got to play above whoever you're playing, especially if it's a team that's not playing well. And the Reds really did everything well. They had solid starting pitching. The bullpen, which was really up in the air all the way into the day before opening day, which also had a lot of question marks in general, has looked very good in the late innings, which has enabled the offense to have these, two late comebacks and then a very nice day on Thursday to kind of rough up the Phillies and feel good about themselves. It's definitely a solid start, something they can hang their hat on for a little while at least, and then now they're going to get into the meat of some tough scheduling with the Pirates, followed by the Cubs, followed by the Cardinals. So now they're going to see their division rivals.
Yeah, it's going to get tougher, no doubt. But to get off to a start like this is certainly promising. And I was surprised in looking back to last year. They also started last year 3-0, and I believe 4-1. Obviously, they did not sustain that during the course of a difficult 2015 season. But maybe things will change here in 2016. But like you said, the competition is about to get much, much tougher. And Mark, a very interesting theme developed there during those first three victories, where it seemed like in each of the wins, guys stepped up to really deliver in clutch situations after going through some struggles earlier in the game. So talk about that from a player perspective, and maybe if the team sort of emphasized during spring training, like, look, it's a long season, it's a grind, we've got to be a little bit mentally tougher to be able to navigate these difficulties as they occur inevitably during the course of a season.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I noticed, and again, I know we have to say small sample size at this point of the year of everything, but one thing I did notice from last year that I didn't see in the first three games of this year is when the Reds were behind early, they stayed behind. And generally, when they made mistakes, those mistakes would pile, like a stone rolling down the hill, would just gather momentum and more mistakes would come. And one of the more, I guess, refreshing things if you're the Reds is they really did kind of just hang in there. Now, of course, the Phillies' bullpen was pretty rough, but at the same time, the Reds created their own luck. So they did some things on the bases. They hit when they needed to hit, and they got it done. It's just going to be, with these guys, when they made mistakes, Joey Votto struck out three times in the first game, and everyone's kind of wondering, what's wrong with Votto? Well, nothing was wrong with him. He's going to strike out sometimes. He's not going to have great at-bats all the time, although you expect it. But when it really counted in the eighth inning, he got it done, and with the game-winning single, two runs, they won the game for them. And then Scott Schebler struck out three times also. And when he was on base with the at bat with the bases loaded in the seventh inning, he hears Jay Bruce yelling at him from first base to just stick with it, keep going. Jay told him in the dugout earlier that he was going to be a key part of the game because he just. These things happen. You got to put away the three strikeouts and focus on the next at bat. And he did. And he hit the game-winning walk-off. I'm sorry, the ninth inning, the walk-off double that won the game for them. And then Bruce himself makes this really not a very Jay Bruce-like play. He kind of rushed a ball that was a routine single and took his eye off of it. Went for an E9 that scored a run and put the Reds behind. But then he came back in the bottom of the inning and had five RBIs with a three-run homer and an RBI single.
Yeah, and as the saying goes, cliched as it is, baseball is a game of failure. Everybody is going to fail at some point. It's how you bounce back from it. And the Reds, in three straight games, three straight wins, have demonstrated that they can put individual failures behind them and come through when it matters most in the clutch. And voila, 3-0 record, certainly a good trend for them and one that they want to continue Now, Mark, last night we saw Robert Stevenson make his big league debut and take up his first career win as a result. Now, the numbers themselves don't really jump off the page, but five decent innings to get the W. And I think the numbers look a little bit better considering that towards the end of spring training, he really had his struggles, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. The two starts that I saw before we left camp in Arizona, he just really wasn't very strong. He lacked command. He kind of lacked composure at times. And the second to last start that I saw, he got sent down only to get brought back from minor league camp for a second crack at the rotation, which he didn't do very well either. Even worse, actually, he had less composure and he had less command. And I was kind of surprised that when the time came that they ended up making him the starter to at least open the season in that third spot. And I will say he was a different pitcher on Thursday. He really did seem to have composure. He seemed to be really in the moment, doing well. He located well. One thing that he may want to work on for the future is that he was living pretty much on his fastball. He really didn't throw a lot of the secondary pitches. That's something he's going to have to do better at and really establish his changeup down the road, because I don't think that's going to bode well for him when the scouting reports and the video starts coming out and they see that he just throws fastball. But, he had it together. And, one of the things that he had to do, unfortunately for him, was the downside of that 8-run rally they got in the fourth inning, that he had to sit in the dugout for about 36 minutes. So he tried to keep warm and go in the tunnel and throw some pitches in the indoor cage. So he did come out a little bit, maybe a little cold when he came back out for the fifth inning, his final inning, and gave up a 2-run homer. But I would say overall he has every reason to be thrilled with his appearance. He's going back to Triple-A Louisville, and then maybe he'll be in position to come up the next time they need a starter.
Yeah, those long innings, like you said, always a double-edged sword. You love to get the run support, but those long layoffs that can really be detrimental. You have to kind of balance those out. But like you said, a lot of positives to build for Robert Stevenson in that first start, so with five innings and getting the win. Now, Mark, as you mentioned, he knew going into the game it was going to be one and done, if you will. He was going to be optioned back to AAA after the game no matter what. So, in a strange way, can that actually be beneficial for a young pitcher in his situation who's obviously going to have some nerves making that first big league start?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a way it takes the risk away from it somewhat. He has nothing to lose by going out and just relaxing and pitching his game and let the results happen as they happen. He knew that the way that with the off days and the way things are lining up, the turn doesn't come up again until the 17th, and they expect John Moscott to take that start. So they really did know that he would be literally a one and done guy, barring a very odd situation. So he was able to kind of get his feet wet. He kind of looked, the way he looked at it is that I got all the firsts out of the way. He got the first strikeout. He got the first pitch. He got to be his first victory. He's got baseballs in his locker and mementos to take with him to Louisville. And when he comes back, it won't be the big to-do. It's going to just be, Robert Stevenson pitching as a major leaguer. And I'm sure he's hoping that the next time he is summoned, that is for good and he can stay for a very long time.
Yeah, and as much hype and hoopla as there is when a youngster makes that big league debut, it's always highly anticipated. In a way, as you said, it's good to get it over with because, like you said, when he comes up for start number two and hopefully many more beyond that, it's just going to be business as usual. Here's the starting pitcher. Go out and do your job. And there won't be so much magnification on every pitch and every burst, like you pointed out. So a good start for Robert Stevenson, and we'll see what lies ahead for him in the future, hopefully the immediate future as far as he's concerned. Marco, what do you think during this 3-0 week for the Reds was the most surprising or eye-opening development you saw from the club during this opening week?
I kind of alluded to a little bit earlier, but I think the most surprising and positive development for them is the performance of the bullpen. Until Kivas Samson gave up a couple runs in Thursday's game, the bullpen hadn't allowed a run in any of their appearances. And I think everybody now from the bullpen, with the exception of Dan Straley, has now been used. So they've had a wide swath of appearances from seven different relievers. They've all done pretty well for the most part, with the exception of Samson. I just think that really does bode well for, if they can keep that together, that's going to be a huge, huge positive for them, because the rotation is not always going to be able to do five, six, seven innings, but it's something that helps them kind of shorten the game. But right now, that was a nice thing to see for the bullpen, because they really were not well-regarded. I had a scout tell me, but right before the very first game, he said the bullpen's going to be an ongoing issue all season. And then they went through three scoreless innings that day. So maybe it will be an issue, but at least for three games, it was not.
Very interesting article you had on Brewers.com about David Stearns. Not to be confused with the former NBA commissioner. This is David Stearns, plural. Slightly different spelling, too. But the Brewers GM, of course, who's going to see his former club in Houston beginning tonight, Friday night, when the Astros come to Miller Park for a three-game set. Now, Stearns, of course, the former assistant GM for a Houston team, which is now a very popular pick to represent the AL in the World Series this year. What were your biggest takeaways in your discussion with David Stearns about encountering the team which he helped construct into right now one of baseball's very best?
Well, the most interesting thing was where I started my story. I asked him to set the scene for me where he was when the Astros played their first postseason game, the AL wild card game against the Yankees. And it was really interesting. He spent 3 years with Jeff Luhnow trying to get the team to that point. Then they finally get there, and David Stearns was at Miller Park for the start of the game, his second full day as the official GM of the Milwaukee Brewers. Then he watched the end of the game at his apartment, which was half empty, you know, still unpacked, moving boxes all over the place. And it was very interesting to me to work that hard for that long to try to bring a franchise to a certain point, then have that franchise get there and not be around to be able to enjoy it, would sort of drive me crazy. So I asked him what it felt like as it was Brian McCann grounding out to Carlos Correa to end that game, and the champagne starts flowing in the Astros clubhouse. You know, what did it feel like in that quiet, empty apartment? And David Stearns basically said it kind of steeled his resolve that's what he wants to do now with this new organization. It was, to him, reinforce the idea that if you have a plan and you stick to that plan for the long term, it is going to pay dividends in the end. And, you know, in Milwaukee, they're obviously at the start of that plan. In Houston, they were at the end of it. And so he sort of spun it around as not a bittersweet moment in any way, but kind of a dig your heels in type moment where he wants to do the same thing now in Milwaukee. He's got ownership on the same page with him. He feels like he has a manager on the same page. And some of that was touched on in that article as well. This is a top-down project where everybody, as David Stearns puts it, needs to be rowing in the same direction. And in time, they believe they can get to where Houston is now.
I give him credit for having that sort of attitude. As, like you said, he's standing in an empty apartment with unpacked boxes all around him. And the thing he worked so hard to achieve, he is miles away from, and he can only watch through a television set. But I give him, like I said, a lot of credit to know that, you know what, I may not be on the scene there, but I am going to be on the scene here in Milwaukee when we do this with this Brewers team. And like you said, the end of the process in Houston, the beginning of the process in Milwaukee. But he is certainly, by many accounts, the right man for this job. And Adam, perhaps not surprising that David Stearns' only major league free agent acquisition this past offseason was someone he's very familiar with, a former Astro, of course, and Chris Carter. Now, he hit a home run on Wednesday to help give the Brewers their first win of the young 2016 season. But I think it was a tie-breaking sack fly later in that same game, which was, to me, a great illustration of the strides that Carter's made as a hitter, because for so long, this guy's been labeled as all or nothing at the plate.
Yeah, well, and look, he has a long way to go to shed that label, because last season was not a good season for him. The batting average slipped below 200. We're not going to measure hitters by batting average. I know we've all moved past that, but it just wasn't a good year for him. So in spring training, the thing that I kept hearing over and over from his teammates, who thought they knew what this guy was going to be, right? Because you see the highlights, all the home runs, 37 homers 2 years ago. They thought they knew what they were going to get, this big, long swing, you know, hulking power hitter. Well, he's the hulking power hitter, but the swing is really short and surprisingly compact. And it's, you know, Ryan Braun was among the guys I talked to who kind of puzzled over the fact that this guy has some of the contact issue that he's had in his career. They feel like, I know Darnell Coles, the Brewers hitting coach, feels this way. Ryan Braun, for example, feels this way. Aaron Hill said the same thing, that with that swing that he's got, he has the potential to improve. And that's what the Brewers are going to try to work on with him. Cut down the strikeouts, He already has a nice walk rate, so his on-base percentage is good for what that batting average is. But they feel like they can get that this is a player who can get that batting average up and become a more complete hitter. So good signs in the early going for him, good signs in spring training. We don't look at the numbers, but you look at the approach that he had, the hard contact that he made was over and over and over all spring. So I think there are some encouraging signs from him. And look, the bottom line for Chris Carter is he's got no one pushing him. This is his gig. So he's got a year here in Milwaukee to show them that he can be an improved hitter. And then the Brewers make a call at the end of the year. It's a one-year free agent contract, but he does have arbitration years beyond this. So if they want it, he could be their free agent, or he could be their first baseman for a couple of years. But it's sort of a one-year audition. There's no prospect breathing down his neck at first base, and he's got a big-time opportunity to get a fresh start with this new team and again, be a more complete hitter.
And like you said, all the tools and all the skills are there. It's just a matter of putting them together. And as you said as well, it's going to take a long time for him to shed that all-or-nothing label, but some encouraging signs on Wednesday, helping Milwaukee to that first win of the season. And Adam, you know, it sounds ridiculous from the perspective of a long, grueling 162-game season lasting 6 months, but how important was it for the Brewers to conclude that series 1-2 as opposed to 0-3, just from a cosmetic standpoint, if you will?
Yeah. From a public relations standpoint, it was big because you go into the first off day of the season, you would have had to sit on a loss for those three losses for the whole off day. The talk of sports radio and on our comments section, et cetera, would be all negative. So it was significant. Look, Jonathan Lucroy said on opening day, we're not going to go 0-162. We're going to win some games, sort of a jab at those who have low expectations for this Brewers team. And he's right. They're going to win some games. They might be a little difficult to come by, but they're looking for bright spots here. And there were a couple in that opening series, and I think Chris Carter was one of them. I think Scooter Jeanette was a big one, a really good series. So a couple of really good plate appearances against left-handed pitchers. That's huge for him at the start of the season because he wants to be an everyday guy. He wants to shed that platoon status. I think for a couple of the relievers, it was a nice start. They're really going to need those guys because they've just been crushed by injuries in the bullpen. And they need, for example, Jeremy Jeffress to be solid when they do have a lead. They need to win those games. And he was very good in his 1-2-3 ninth inning on Wednesday. So there were some bright spots. And I think, you know, Craig Counsell, it's going to be part of his job to accentuate those positives. And then, you know, try to improve the areas where they struggle at. There were defensive lapses in the series, but also good moments. So, you know, Craig Counsell is going to have to be sort of a beacon of positivity here. Those coaches are going to have to keep players up as the losses mount. And that's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the managerial job. It's more than just X's and O's on the field. It's playing team psychologists sometimes. And given the state that the Brewers are in, there's going to be a lot of that for Craig Counsell and that coaching staff here in 2016. But as you said, a lot of positives to build on in that opening series, despite dropping 2 out of 3. And you mentioned Scooter Jeanette, and you know, one more reason why we love baseball and why it drives us crazy at the same time. I think I looked up, Jeanette had not homered in his final 34 games of last year. He's going up against Madison Bumgarner, who had only given up 2 homers to lefties all of last year. What happens? He takes him upper tank. So it's just one of those things that you just never know what you're going to get in this crazy game of baseball. Scooter Jeanette, a bright spot for the Brewers in that opening series. Adam, another bright spot, Aaron Hill, made a very nice defensive play in the game on Wednesday as he embarks on a very new journey as an everyday third baseman, and this is 12th season in the major leagues. Again, a small sample size as we're all dealing with here in the opening week, but it seems like, you know, between these three games and what you saw in spring training, he is getting more comfortable out there and really making a home at the hot corner.
Yeah, and the way Craig Counsell, who knows all about bouncing around the infield, and Aaron Hill both talk about this is you just want to check the boxes on certain plays. So, in other words, the goal in spring training was to get Aaron Hill out there enough that he gets a variety of different plays. You know, balls to his left, backhand where he has to pop up and throw, going back, and communicating with the left fielder on short fly balls, all charging balls, barehanding, all these different variety of plays that you have to be comfortable with at third base they're new to Aaron Hill. He's played, you know, something like 70 games at third base in his first 11 years in the big league. So he was able to check the boxes off on a lot of those different plays. And the way Kirk Counsell tells it, a good smart player like Aaron Hill, he can take that play once in spring training, and now it's in his toolbox. And it's he's had that experience, and the next time around, he's going to be better at it. And it's a play that he's got in his you know, again, in his toolbox. So the play he made on Wednesday that stood out was a in foul ground, a pop-up over his head, and he made an over-the-shoulder catch. Our StatCast number said it was the furthest a third baseman has gone to make a catch in, you know, as long as we've been keeping this data. So that's all of last season and this season at least.
StatCast never lies.
And throw home to double up Buster Posey at the plate. A really good double play early in the game where it was Taylor Youngman pitching for Milwaukee. Not a great game for him, but it really kept a big inning from emerging. And it was, you know, that's a big red check mark for him if he's checking boxes on these plays. So that was a big positive, and you can even expand it beyond Aaron Hill at third base. There's questions, big questions, about how the Brewers are going to play on the left side of the infield with Hill and Jonathan VR. Those two both had a really good series against the Giants, all three games. So I think that was a big positive for Kirk Counsell. Look, small sample, tiny sample, and there's going to be errors from those players as the season goes on. But a really good start for each of them defensively.
Pirates fans feeling pretty good about themselves and their team right now, and there's hard to find much fault with a 3-0 start, especially when the three wins came against division foe St. Louis. And was there perhaps, maybe I'm making too much out of this because of the nature of baseball and because it's a new season, but, you know, here's the Pirates. They win 98 games last season, and they look across the field, and the team that was the reason indirectly for them being in the wild card game is that team, St. Louis, because they won 100 games. The Pirates back in the wild card game, we know how that turned out. So is there perhaps a little extra motivation in that Pirates clubhouse to say, you know what, we're not going to let that happen this year. We've got the Pirates in our house for three. Let's really take it to them. Any of that play in, or maybe not so much?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly not going to say that publicly, but they very much realize, you know, that their best chance to avoid the scenario that's played out the last 2 years is to be better than the Cardinals and be better than the Cubs. So, I mean, yeah, they're not going to come out and say, listen, we need to go 3-0 to open the season because we got to beat the Cardinals this year. But, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of added motivation to avoid the wild card game, to, you know, win the division, to play better, first of all, against their own division competition. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really encouraging way to start the season, to go 3-0 against anybody, but especially against, you know, a good team and a division rival.
Yeah, absolutely. And the three wins were all of different nature. They had the dominant pitching performance in the opener. They had the walk-off win in game two, and then, you know, a little bit of everything in game three. So they not only won, but showed different ways to win three straight games against a very good St. Louis team. So that was big for the Pirates there. Adam, transitioning a little bit to some big off-the-field news that came during that series against the Cardinals. Gregory Polanco signed to a 5-year, $35 million contract extension. Tell us what this deal accomplishes on both sides for the team and for the player Polanco, and why the Pirates felt that this was the right time right now to commit this sort of money to one of their young, up-and-coming stars.
Yeah, well, they've been trying to get it done for the last 2 years, really. Something Polanco has been interested in. Obviously, the Pirates want to lock up their young stars. They've done it with Andrew McCutchen before, Starling Marte. They did it last year with Josh Harrison. And before all that, they did it with less good results with Jose Tabata, the outfielder who's now with the Dodgers. But, you know, it's a good move. It provides cost certainty for the team that, you know, even if Polanco really does break out this year, as so many of us have predicted, that they have him for a set cost, that 5 years, $35 million. And then if it turns out, you know, that he is a star, you have him on a really affordable team-friendly contract with, you know, the potential for 7 years and $58 million once you count his team options there at the end of the deal. And then for Polanco, you know, it's certainty. It's not having to worry about a contract every year. It's knowing, you know, that they're not going to send you to AAA. They're not going to, you know, do anything like that. They have committed to this player, and Polanco is committed to the team in return. It's something that's worked out for them well, like I said, with McCutchen and Marte, and I think it's probably going to work out well with Harrison. And know, the Pirates believe that Gregory Polanco is one of their building block players. It's, you know, one of the phrases Neil Huntington used to describe him when they announced the deal on Tuesday. And if, you know, if they can get that kind of player once again locked up to this kind of deal, that's how small market teams or lower payroll teams kind of have to operate. So I think it's a move that makes sense for both sides. I think they both probably would have liked to have gotten it done, you know, a year or two ago, but they finally came to an agreement that they could both be happy with.
So Polanco is locked up for the foreseeable future, and another guy that if he continues on this trajectory of his that started at spring training and extended through opening day, not opening day, but his first start of the year, could be Juan Nicasio. Maybe that's a guy that gets himself a big contract somewhere down the road. That's another discussion, but Nicasio, you know, what a story he's been. We've talked about it in previous weeks about the breakout spring that he had, and then the real first test against, you know, the reigning division champions, his first regular season start, and lo and behold, you know, the guy doesn't miss a beat. Six innings, two hits, one run, seven Ks for Nicasio. And, Adam, even after this remarkable spring that he did have, was there still a sense going into that first start that he had to validate those numbers and validate that performance by doing exactly what he did in that start?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's going to continue to be a question as the season goes on. Basically, until he does falter, I think people are going to start, are going to ask, you know, when is this going to end? When is this going to kind of fade? Because it's just so far off the career that he's had. You know, he's still kind of the same guy, good fastball, good slider, occasionally throws a changeup, but it's not really a strong pitch. So he's basically a two-pitch guy, and that's the kind of guy that typically works better out of the bullpen than in the rotation. So, yeah, I mean, there's going to be some skepticism going forward, but I think you saw what he's capable of in that first start against the Cardinals, and that's, you know, it's like you said, we've talked about it, that reliever mentality. If you do approach each batter, you know, like you're going, you know, like this is the game on the line, then, you know, maybe that stuff plays up a little bit. And the raw stuff itself, it's not to discount that. It's, you know, the fastball touched 98. I think a slider clocked in on game day at 90 miles an hour. Like, that's rare, elite stuff. So if he can continue to control it, continue to, you know, turn the lineup over a couple of times, then I think that's all the Pirates could possibly ask for out of him. And you talk about a long-term contract. This is a guy that they got for 1 year, $3 million, going up against, in his debut, Mike Leake, who signed for 5 years and $80 million. And the Pirates have Nicasio arbitration eligible next year, too. So, great deal for them, you know, however it works out, especially if he keeps up this kind of performance.
Yeah, advantage Pirates in the financial department there between himself and Mike Leake, no question there. I don't know if Juan Nicasio is a big talker. I don't know how many discussions you had with him during spring training, but if you did have the chance to talk to him on an extensive basis, how much, if at all, did he mention Ray Searidge and the work that he's done with him in getting him to this point where he's been such a breakout star for the Pirates here in the early stages of the season?
Yeah, we actually talked to him a lot about Ray Searidge after that crazy spring game he had where he struck out 10 of the 14 Orioles he faced in four innings. And, you know, he said the same thing that a lot of guys have said about Ray, is that it's not so much about the technical and mechanical changes as it is about the attitude and the confidence that he instills in guys. You know, Ray's bullpens are some of the most vocal things you'll hear in baseball. He sits there behind the catcher and he cheers him on. You know, every single pitch that he likes, he'll give him an attaboy or a there you go or that's what I like to see. And I think that works for guys. You know, they want to hear the positive. You know they're their harshest critics for the most part. So if they have a guy who's going to, you know, accentuate the positive and stuff like that, I think that plays well for even a, you know, a major league pitcher. Guys, you know, you would think that they're doing it professionally. They don't need that kind of encouragement or whatever. But, you know, they're out there playing the game. They need to hear when they're doing well. And Ray emphasizes that. And, you know, with a guy like Nicasio especially, somebody who does have a lot of positives that you can focus on, I think it's going to play up rather than focusing on the, you know, the control issues or the trouble turning the lineup over a third time. If you focus on what he does well and get him to, you know, zero in on that and exploit that to the best of his ability, it's probably going to work out well.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, accentuate the positive and downplay the negative. It sounds it's simple, you know, and why more people and more coaches don't do it, I don't know, but Ray Searidge does, and we see the results with these reclamation projects, if you will, Juan Nicasio being the latest of those. So a great start for him and a great start for Francisco Liriano. Can't overlook him and what he did on opening day, a 10K performance to get the Pirates off and running. And, you know, obviously – Liriano's been very, very good in his tenure with the Pirates. He's not the pitcher he was during his heyday with the Twins when he paired up with Johan Santana to form that dynamic 1-2 duo. But, again, he's still been very, very good. And I think that, you know, he's even a little bit unheralded at this stage of his career. He is the de facto ace of the staff until Gerrit Cole comes back and returns to full health. And to have a guy with that pedigree at the top of your rotation, at least temporarily, is huge for this team.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, when Gerrit Cole wasn't able to start opening day, there wasn't a whole lot of trepidation about whether, you know, where the rotation went from there. You know, they had Francisco Liriano ready to go. This is the guy who started opening day now each of the last 3 years. He's got the strikeout stuff, which you saw right away on opening day. Command is sometimes an issue, which you also saw on opening day with five walks. But, you know, this is a guy who works hard off the field. He takes everything seriously. He's a leader in that clubhouse in kind of a quiet, understated way. And I think he is unheralded, like you said, throughout baseball. You know, guy who's turned into a really consistent pitcher. I think if he was, you know, throwing 200 innings or had a higher win total or something like that, people might recognize a little more what he's done. But, no, I think they feel very good with that 1-2 top of the rotation with Gerrit Cole and Francisco Liriano.
Liriano, a great opening day performance and a lot to look forward to when Gerrit Cole returns to the fold. Adam, as we come down the home stretch here, when you look at the first three games and just the week in general for the Pirates, as again we're speaking here on a Friday evening, what was, in your eyes, the most unexpected or eye-opening development that you saw so far this week?
I was really intrigued by Clint Hurdle's bullpen management, actually. Tony Watson, I think we probably talked about on this podcast, is an eighth-inning reliever. He's probably one of the best eighth-inning relievers in baseball. And then the first three games of the season, he was pitching in the seventh inning. Because Clint Hurdle is focusing more on things like leverage and, you know, matchups in the bullpen, not just strict seventh, eighth, ninth roles. You're not going to see Mark Melancon pitch anywhere but in a save opportunity. So there are some limits, but I think with Tony Watson, he's, you know, he's willing to deploy his best reliever wherever it, you know, wherever the situation calls for it. And that was in the seventh inning in those first three games. I think that's interesting because like he's doing with the lineup and like the team is doing with the lineup, batting McCutchen second, Jaso first, even if it's a little, you know, against the traditional establishment type thing, it shows that they're willing to do whatever they can, taking all the data and information they have to get the most out of this team. And that's, again, going back to the thing with Polanco, that's another way that a small market, lower payroll team has to operate. You have to find advantages where you can get them. And in this case, it's not so much the players you have, but how you're using them. So I think the fact that Hurdle was willing to divert from that eighth-inning role with Watson and the fact that Watson was willing to accept it is pretty interesting to me.
Start things off, I'm going to throw a number out there for Cardinals fans who may be a little down in the dumps after the week the Cardinals just had. That number is 1.85%. That number is the portion of the baseball schedule which is completed, meaning there's a long way to go. Now, obviously, you never want to start out 0-3 as the Cardinals have, but I think it's good to, you know, gather a little bit of perspective before we start jumping off bridges here. Yes, a slow start, but, you know, any reason for concern here? Because I really don't see it.
Yeah, no, I mean, we are talking the smallest of sample sizes, so I appreciate that the percentage that you calculated there. And, you know, if this is a three-day stretch in, say, July, you know, certainly disappointing, especially the way the Cardinals play. They didn't play crisp baseball at all, you know, while losing three games. But if this is a three-day stretch in the middle of summer, you know, we kind of play it off as, you know, this is what happens over the course of 162. Certainly, I think it's augmented just the fact that it's the first week of the season, that it happened in Pittsburgh to a division rival. You know, and I think, you know, if you want to talk about concern, I think the only kind of reason for maybe a hint of concern is that the way the Cardinals played in Pittsburgh is, quite frankly, kind of the way they played through much of spring. Just not very crisp defensively. The offense really lagging. I think what was maybe most surprising in Pittsburgh was the starting pitching wasn't as effective as we had seen both now in spring and then obviously last year, this rotation coming off an historic season. So, I don't know. It just kind of looks jagged. It looks stale, the start to the season. That being said, the Cardinals now have a three-game series against the Braves. They go home. They host the Brewers and the Reds. So when you talk about getting back on track, those are three teams of the Cardinals. You know, the expectation is that they're going to, you know, go somewhere this season. Those are the types of teams they need to beat up on.
Yeah, exactly. Three very winnable series there, to put it kindly. So, again, not a lot of reason for concern, easy for me to say. Now, something that Cardinals fans may not want to hear, something that you pointed out in a recent article, the last time they started 0-3 was 2007. That's perhaps coincidentally or not their last losing season. They finished six games below 500 in 07 at 78-84. But nonetheless, how much does it kind of benefit the Cardinals to have a number of veterans on this team who have the experience in navigating these peaks and valleys and can put these things in perspective, as opposed to a younger team where guys may not be as well equipped to handle the disappointment of an 0-3 start?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a sense of panic, certainly, in Pittsburgh, you know, going down to the clubhouse after that third game. You know, you could certainly tell that the team was absolutely disappointed by what had just happened during this day, but there was no panic. There was no "the sky is falling" kind of feeling in there. You know, you mentioned that 07 team, you know, one that fans might want to lock into, because in 2011, that team lost its first two games, and it lost six out of its first eight. Let's not forget how that season ended up with a world championship. So slow starts happen, and you're right. These players that have been here before have been through some slow starts. I think the fact that this team always, it seems like, opens on the road, you know, certainly doesn't work in their favor to getting off to a quick start. The fact that they jumped from 80, 90-degree temps in Florida to 30s in Pittsburgh, I don't think necessarily helped the offense get on track. So, yeah, there is no panic. I think the panic is right now kind of just comprised by the fan base that wants to see their team win. But certainly if this extends much longer, you know, you do then kind of shoulder a little bit of a monkey on your back until you get that first win.
Yeah, exactly. And like you pointed out at the onset, if this is the NFL, you start 0-3, that's a death sentence. Starting 0-3 in Major League Baseball, it's a blip on the radar. And you pointed out the upcoming series ahead for this Cardinals team, and not a lot of reason, if any, for concern right here with the Cardinals again at 0-3 as we speak on Friday, April 8th. Now, Jennifer, very interesting development on Tuesday, which you wrote about. And again, the Cardinals eventually lost in extras, 6-5 and 11. But in the ninth inning of that game, a tie game on the road, we saw Mike Matheny trot out his closer, Trevor Rosenthal, and he would push the game into extra innings as the Pirates did not score in the bottom of that ninth inning. Now, this is something, this is always a debate with every team, every manager. You know, they have their own philosophies, their own strategies, their own beliefs. But this is something that Matheny would be very hesitant to do in the past. What do you think prompted his change in strategy, at least thus far?
Yeah, I mean, he said he has spent a lot of time kind of pouring through numbers, talking to people in the game, and then, you know, this idea of, do you save your closer for a save situation on the road, or do you use him to try to even maybe get to that save situation? You know, Mike Matheny kind of falls in the middle in this. You know, you have some managers that believe their closer, we're going to save the closer until it's a save situation. End of story. You have others that are maybe a little more new age thinkers that, you know, would rather maybe use their best pitcher in a game instead of let him sit in a bullpen and perhaps go through the whole game and never get used. It might kind of falls in the middle. He still believes that that save situation is a different animal. You know, and certainly he has a guy in Trevor Rosenthal who's been very effective in that role. That being said, he has also seen it play out in recent years where he has held Trevor out and the game never gets to him. And then, in essence, you've let your best pitcher just sit there, and usually it turns out negatively for your team. So it's something he's going to consider. There were other factors that played into it as well on Tuesday, one of those being just the fact that Trevor hadn't pitched since the previous Thursday. So they really wanted to get him in the game at some point, and that provided an opportunity. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that Mike is a little bit more open-minded to this. I think, too, that his personnel in the bullpen allows him to be a little bit more open-minded. He has a number of guys in that bullpen who are former closers, you know, Son Juan Oh from Korea, Jonathan Broxton, Figueres and Maina filled in as closers last year. So if you use Rosenthal maybe in a spot last year where you wouldn't, you still typically are going to have a guy or two in that bullpen who he's comfortable throwing into a potential save situation later in the game. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out if he'll do it again, but it was certainly caught my eye as something that just seemed to be an evolution for Mike Matheny as a manager.
Yeah, this is always an age-old debate, like I said, with every team, every season, this particular scenario. Do you throw your closer in there or not? But you made a great point in that, you know, Rosenthal is the closer, but other guys in that bullpen have closing experience. So it's a huge benefit to Mike Matheny to be able to mix and match his options. It didn't work out in this particular instance, but we'll see what happens the next time if the situation arises in the Cardinals' next road game, a tie game of the ninth inning, what Mike Matheny does. Jennifer, moving forward here, during this first week for the Cardinals, again, a difficult one, but what are some of the more unexpected or perhaps eye-opening developments that you've noticed from the press box?
Yeah, if we want to start with some positives amid all this doom and gloom, you know, I think the way the bullpen has started has certainly been encouraging. I don't think it's a surprise to most that this, you know, could be a strength of this team moving forward. They covered 11 innings in those three games in Pittsburgh, allowed three earned runs. Sonjuan Oh, in particular, just dominant, piling up the strikeouts already. So very good kind of first signs from the bullpen. You know, on the position player side, Jeremy Hazelbaker and Jed Jerko, both, you know, newcomers to this team, got off to good starts. Actually, those two have the only home runs thus far for the team. But some nice offensive numbers from those two. And I think if you look on the flip side, I'm surprised by the way Randall Grichuk has gotten off to his start here. He had a very good spring. You know, for a team that didn't have a lot of standout offensive performers down in Florida, Randall Grichuk was one of them. That being said, he comes into the series in Atlanta 1-for-10 with 6 strikeouts. And has actually benched on Wednesday, essentially, to give him some time to work through some kinks in his swing. So a little bit surprised to see the slow start there offensively. And then on the pitching side, as I mentioned earlier, a little bit surprised at kind of the rustiness that seemed to be there, both for Wainwright and Waka and Leak, guys who all finished spring on a pretty strong note and seemed to be very comfortable with where they were mechanically, all had different issues. Wainwright with his curveball, Walker with his changeup, and Mike Leake just in general with his command. So it's not totally abnormal coming out of spring that first time, you know, through the rotation. I think it'll be interesting to see how each of those guys rebounds in the next few days when they get back out on the mound, and if they can kind of clean up those mechanical issues in a big way.
Kerry, thank you for the time. And it would seem impossible that anything could overshadow such a dominant start by the Cubs at 3-0, scoring a million runs, but all anybody is talking about on this Friday afternoon, unfortunately, is the injury sustained on Thursday night by Kyle Schwarber in the Cubs win against the Diamondbacks. Kerry, just kind of talk about the play where he was injured on Thursday night and the very latest update on his health status.
Okay, Kyle was in left field and Dexter Fowler in center, and Gene Segura, the D-backs, hit a ball into no man's land. It went to left center. Neither one of them could really get the ball. Later, Schwarber told us that he had talked to Fowler, and both players admitted that, you know, neither one called for it either because they weren't sure who could get to it. The two got went after it. They got tangled up. If you watch the replay, which Schwarber has, and it's hard to watch, but it's his left leg got tangled up the most with Fowler. The initial reports are a sprained ankle. However, and a lot of people thought, phew, that's it. But the left knee is a big concern, and Schwarber was to undergo an MRI Friday. We will not get any information from the Cubs until probably closer to when the clubhouse opens, which is 3.5 hours before the game, which doesn't help you and doesn't help the fans, because right now they're all pestering on Twitter asking me when we're getting an update. I mean, I don't know. They don't allow me in the operating room, so I don't know. But Schwarber had just a great attitude yesterday. As he said, quote, "You can't get mad about playing hard and getting hurt." He said, "I'd rather play hard and get hurt than play not hard and get hurt." So, you know, he was actually more concerned about Dexter Fowler's status, and so were some of his teammates. I mean, Schwarber was recruited to play linebacker at Ohio State, so he's not a little guy. So for him to go and tackle Fowler, he was a little concerned. I guess we didn't get a chance to talk to Fowler after the game. Heard he was a little banged up, but he stayed in the game, so that's a good thing. So.
And you know, yeah, like you said, Schwarber, you know, this guy, he's a linebacker masquerading as a left fielder in the major leagues. And for Dexter Fowler to come away relatively unscathed is pretty remarkable. Kerry, when the play first happened, before you got time to process everything and watch 100 replays, when it first happened, what was your reaction? Was it, you know, oh, my goodness, this is major, this is huge? What was going through your head?
Thought it was major and huge because Schwarber is lying there on the ground on his stomach and obviously in pain. And I think part of that could have been that, I mean, you could tell something bad was going to happen as soon as you saw the two of them going there. And I know we joked with Madden that during the spring training that Dexter Fowler is going to have to be careful because he's got Jason Hayward in right field. Jason Hayward is a big man, and then you've got Schwarber in left, and he's a big man, and Fowler's going to have to be really careful out there in center because he's got two big guys, you know, coming at him. But no, you could tell when you were watching the play as it was unfolding, you could tell something bad was going to happen. It did. To see Schwarber on the ground like that was tough. But I think it just took him some time to kind of process what hurt. And then he finally sat up, tried to walk, but he was like the furthest part of the field from the dugout. So they brought the cart out as a precaution. The knee is the concern, you know, nothing is broken, which is good. But the knee is a concern and we really just have to wait.
Yeah. A lot of speculation at this point, but like you said, a lot of wait and see, because until the clubhouse doors open, we're all going to be in the dark a little bit about what officially is the word on Kyle Schwarber. Kerry, let's assume, and I think this is a safe assumption, he is going to miss some time. How much time remains to be seen, but assuming that he does miss time, what would be the Cubs' outfield plan moving forward?
Well, really, they have a lot of depth, and that's a good thing. So the team is one of the goals this offseason is to prepare for something like this. Matt Caesar, Jorge Soler can easily sub there in left field. Caesar's played really well, as David Ross said the other day, he's hot as a match. So Caesar could fill in. I know it's two right-handed hitters. They lose a catcher, but Schwarber, actually the sad thing is Schwarber was going to catch tonight, Friday night, with Jason Hamill. They'd been paired up all spring, and I know he was looking forward to that probably more than playing outfield, so I'm sure he's bummed about that too. But no, they can do that. Unfortunately, Javi Baez, who they thought might be ready by Monday, which is the home opener, he had a little bit of a setback. He followed the ball off his face. It's not serious, but he hasn't played any games, and you can't just activate him unless he gets a little more game time. So he's an option. They could consider – Shane Victorino's been rehabbing, but he's not ready either. He doesn't have the at-bats. I'm not sure – you know, they've got Tommy LaSella who can sub. They put Chris Bryant in left field when Schwarber was hurt. So they also have that option. And Heimer, I mean, I'm just throwing out a name here, but Heimer Candelario is in their minor league system and played well at third. And, you know, who knows if they want to accelerate that. They like him a lot. I think they have enough depth that they can handle this. I guess I personally feel really bad for Schwarber because he had a really good spring, and like I say, tonight would have been his night to catch, and I'm sure he was looking forward to that.
Yeah, very disappointing, but as you said at the onset, his attitude about this whole thing has been remarkable, and maybe that will create some good karma and accelerate the recovery process. We'll see Kyle Schwarber back in action before anybody expects to, and again, as we speak here on a Friday afternoon, We await the official word, and hopefully it's not too severe, and he is back before we know it. Kerry, I want to go back to Dexter Fowler a little bit, the second guy involved in this collision back on Thursday night. And you said on this podcast last week when I asked you, you know, who's a guy that could turn some heads and surprise some people, maybe somebody that's not on the radar, and immediately you said Dexter Fowler. Lo and behold, this guy's off to a blistering start, and what a pleasant surprise he's been for the Cubs so far.
Yeah, you can say surprised. I don't think the Cubs are surprised. Like I think, as I said before on the when talking to you, you know, Madden said that he liked his team before Fowler returned, and when Dexter came back, and he said it felt right or felt good. But now when Dexter came back, everything felt right. And Dexter really, you know, it's a you go, we go. That's what Madden says to him when he goes up before every at-bat. They did that last year. He continued it this year, which is kind of cute. And Dexter has produced. I mean, I don't think he's going to maintain a .583 average for the whole season, but he's getting the job done, and that's terrific. And I think having Jason Hayward behind him is a nice fit. Joe's still, you know, yes, the Cubs are going crazy with runs. I mean, I think, where was it? I just had a note where they've outscored their opponents in the first three games by 22 runs, which is their largest run differential in three games in franchise history. I mean, that, you know, a lot of that is Fowler kind of getting things started, Hayward continuing it and sort of stretching it down the line. I mean, even John Lackey started Thursday night, and he said that he was really impressed with with how the lineup is and how, you know, you've got Addison Russell batting eighth or ninth, and Addison Russell is a legitimate guy that could be up higher in the order as well. So, you know, it's nice to see that kind of length in the lineup.
Yeah, it's just been tremendous depth, 1 through 9, and you brought up that eye-popping stat. 29 runs scored, 7 runs allowed, the plus 22 run differential, the 3-0 record. I mean, they are just firing on all cylinders right now. And, Kerry, even for a team for whom the bar has been set so high and expectations are so through the roof, are you even taken aback a little bit at just how, you know, not the fact that they're just winning, they're dominating coming out of the gate here?
Well, they knew they wanted to take advantage of the nice weather, that's for sure. I heard it snowing in Chicago for the White Sox opener, which is kind of a bummer. But they wanted to take advantage of this. They knew that the lineup was loaded once you added, you know, Hayward and Zobrist into there. It's really the main theme that I've noticed in the first three games is that the team really feels like this is just a continuation from last year. It's as if there was no off season. You know, they've just picked up. They've said, okay, we got this far in the NLCS. Now we're gonna let's keep going. This is what we need to do better. The impressive thing is their at-bats, they're grinding them out. I hate to use that cliche, but they're just grinding them out. They get 2 strikes, they don't care, they'll work the pitcher, they're making every pitcher work hard. There are no easy outs in the lineup, and it's if they can maintain this, it could be pretty fun to watch.